Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euro.
Good morning, Dave Garrity.
Yeah, good morning. How are you? Very, microphone.
Delighted you're here. Obviously, in the past and still there, one of our most successful and well-loved bands, Bellex One, you're part of that. But you formed your own solo project, which you're calling Join Me in the Pines. Tell me about it.
That's it. Yeah, it has been going for a number of years. I just put out the second album under that title there late last year. First one being 2014. With Inherit, and yeah, there's a real change of direction with this new album, where the previous album was quite dark folk and cinematic, and this album is embracing the spirit of Bowie and Prince, and wholeheartedly, 110%, you know, among many other people, like lots of soul tunes, disco, Womack and Womack, guys like that. So My buddy Mick is here with me, who co-produced
Mick Major.
Mick Major,
great name, Mick.
Yeah. He doesn't have a microphone, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But
he's very far away.
But yeah, no, Mick co-produced this with me and absolutely steered the ship, and helped me discover new capabilities that I had and that we could have as working partners. So yeah, it's very, very exciting.
Which is great. And you've got lots of gigs coming up, haven't you? Tell me, there's one, obviously, Other Voice in Ballina coming up soon.
Yeah, it's great to be part of that. We're invited to come down and play on next Friday night, 28th, in the old Shebeen. And then the next night we're in Dublin's Bloody Mary's on South William Street.
Then you're going to Belfast, I think?
Up in Belfast, yeah, for the Cathedral. I can't speak this morning, Miriam. What's going on?
Cathedral Quarter Arts Festival.
Thank you so much.
I have it written down, mind you.
How am I going to sing in a minute if I can't speak? And then we're up in Derry then on April 18th.
So, yeah, that's in the Sandines, isn't it?
Sandino's, yeah. It's a great little venue in Derry that I've heard a lot about but haven't been to yet.
So. Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's a beautiful city. Yeah. Right, what are you going to sing for us this morning?
So this is a new song, a new single. It's called Feel So Heavy. And there's a lovely video actually for this on line where we teamed up with, there's a Northern Irish filmmaker called Roy Spence, and he, back in his day, him along with his twin brother, they used to make homemade movies, and they experimented in sci-fi and special effects and all this kind of stuff back in the 50s and 60s.
Wow.
So you can imagine, you know, the type of effects they got, very, very organic. And so basically I saw some of his stuff and I thought, I'll definitely get in touch with this guy and see if he'll let me use some of his footage for a music video. So I edited the music video for Feel So Heavy. It's up on YouTube. Check it out.
And if someone's looking at it, what should they put into YouTube?
Feels So Heavy. Join Me in the Pines.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Off you go, Dave and Mick.
Let's do this.
Stay out all night. I wanna see you by candlelight. Try not to stare as we dive into the pool of each other's eyes. I'm here to show you, baby, you're still a queen. I'm so busy building our living dream. Oh, the honey of your lips. I miss the sweet pain of your kiss, and it feels so heavy. Down. I wanna
I love it. If only, I wish our listeners could have seen as well. They could be. Mick Major's literally bopping around the studio.
Yep.
Thank you both so much. That's fab. And listen, just to say, Dave, Eilish Kennedy tweeted in to say, great to hear Dave Geraghty making such music as always. I was his teacher way back in the day. He's a sound Eilish man. That must be Miss Kennedy.
Yes.
Yes.
Science teacher.
There you go. So she's very
geography.
Proud. It doesn't matter.
Yeah,
she was great. Whatever.
Hello, hello, Eilish.
Yeah.
Lovely to
so
see
listen,
you.
And someone else says, tweeting in to say, ask him about his composition, which I don't have time for, but I know you compose lots of great music for film and TV.
Yes, yeah, it's something I've gotten into. Yes.
So listen, thanks both so much.
Thank you so much.
Best
of
luck with everything. Thanks so much for being here. We move on. Well, we are the country which voted for marriage equality. We like to think that we are all so much more accepting of difference and non-judgmental of those making lifestyle choices different from our own. But for gay men and women, the threat on the streets of abuse and even violence still simmers. Novelist and lecturer Gavin McRae, who is currently writer in residence in the University of Limerick, wrote a wonderful piece in last weekend's Irish Times, which detailed the reality of walking the streets of Ireland when you are gay. And I'm glad to say Gavin is with me now in our studio. Good morning, Gavin McRae.
Good morning.
I'll mention later, you're not here to mention it, you wrote the most wonderful book about Mrs. Engels, but we'll talk about that later. You couldn't talk to me last weekend when we invited you in, Gavin, after that piece in the Irish Times, because you were still in bandages and gauze.
Yeah.
Tell me what happened to you.
Well, I was walking home from the library in Dublin at 6 in the evening on a Saturday evening, minding my own business, talking on the phone, and a group of six 12 to 14-year-olds attacked me from behind and broke my nose and my cheekbone.
When you were telling us this earlier, even to Dave and Mick, we were all going, it's hard to believe that this happened. It was in broad daylight.
Well, no, it was dark at 6 in the evening at that stage.
Okay.
And that was what was frightening for me was that it was dark and I was walking beside a dark river. So it was quite frightening in that sense. But I'm kind of surprised about how surprised everyone is, because this is something that I've been dealing with all of my life. And I think a lot of other gay people have been dealing with it too. So I'm sort of surprised that people think that just because a law changes that, you know, change to happen, it needs to be much deeper than a law. And, you know, I'm not as surprised as others.
Yeah. And we'll go back to your childhood and those experiences. But like, what did those young people do? Did you know you were in trouble?
Well, I walked past them and I heard them say something, but I was on the phone, so I ignored them. And then they started to throw pebbles at me, stones at me from behind. Mm. And that was the first moment when I said, okay, this is a situation, something's happening. But I continued to ignore it and then continued on the path. And then I started to be pushed from behind. And it was then that I began to get nervous. And when I turned around, I realized there were six of them. And at that stage, it was more irritation and nerves rather than actual fear, because I thought these are kids, you know, they're just bored. You know, I'll get myself out of the situation. So I started to flag down some cars and that got rid of them, I thought. And then I continued on the path. And then about 5 minutes later, they had obviously followed me. And in a particular dark part of the path, they attacked me from behind. So what they were saying to me was, originally they were throwing stones at me and saying, answer me, you faggot. Why aren't you answering me, you faggot? What's your problem, you faggot? And of course, I wasn't answering. You know, I have 42 years experience with this. You don't engage with this kind of thing. You just keep going, try and get out of it. And so maybe it was my non-engagement that gave them permission in their minds to say, actually, this is a faggot that we're dealing with here, and we can attack this person.
And then they did attack you.
And then they did attack me, from behind, and pushed me on the ground, and then punched and kicked me in the face until my nose and cheekbone were broken. Yeah,
it's actually so shocking, Gavin. So sorry that happened to you.
Thank you very much.
But you were saying tomorrow you wanted to talk. This is no surprise to you. Tell me about growing up.
Well, my first memory of receiving homophobic abuse, I was 10 years old and I was receiving it from other 10-year-olds. So the one point I want to make is this is not really about the relationships I have or what I do in bed. And really, it's some kind of perception that people have of my performance as a boy at that stage, but then later on as a man. Mm. So I think we really need to focus on that perception that people have about how men should be behaving and how men shouldn't be behaving. So, but the first homophobic abuse that I received was just the word gay. It wasn't the word faggot yet. The faggot came later in secondary school, maybe 12 or 13. I started to hear the word faggot. But I was first called gay. My name is Gavin McRae, so I was called Gavin McGay And I remember not having much of a problem with this word. My first fantasies as a young child were of Superman scooping me up in his arms and taking me away to a desert island, and I would live alone with Superman. He would never have to rescue anyone else because he'd have only me to look after, a bit like Robinson Crusoe and Man Friday or something like that. And so I was quite comfortable with these images that I had in my mind of relationships with men. And I knew what the word gay meant, and it was never a problem with me, but I knew that the way it was being said, laughing, jeering, sneering, that for other people, this was a really upsetting thing to be, or it was really a wrong thing to be. I think I was also self-aware enough to know why they were saying it. When I was in primary school, I was a little bit of an actor, a bit of a showman, a bit of a clown. I was in the school plays. I had a voice, so I would sing in mass. And I always wanted to be at the forefront of, you know, the plays. And one year, for example, I was Joseph in the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. The following year, I presumed I would be the lead role again. And my teacher decided they were going to do Rumpelstiltskin. And so I couldn't be the lead role because I was one of the taller boys, so they needed one of the shorter boys to play that. So I went for the role of princess, got the role of princess. This to me was entirely natural. It was entirely normal that if I couldn't be the lead role, I would at least be the kind of, you know, the second in line. So in front of the whole community, all the neighbors, the mothers, the fathers, and the whole school, I played the princess with a tutu and a blonde wig and lipstick. And this came entirely naturally to me. This was not something I knew. I was being funny, and I knew I was breaking rules. But the fact of dressing up in that way was never questioned in my mind. So I knew on some level why I was being called gay, but what I was doing was never wrong to me in my own mind.
And then talking to you earlier, I mean, you think sometimes, not quite using Rory's check yourself, but talking to you about how you want to try and change things. Yeah. Tell me how things could change, do you think, for the better?
Well, I've been asked the question, what do you see? Yeah. What changes do you want to see? And then, of course, the change I would like to see is an end to this kind of violence. But I think it's kind of a little bit hopeless for me in my own mind to be asking for that, because it feels like, you know, when a beauty queen gets on stage and said, I want world peace, you know, it's a little bit hopeless. War is not going to end tomorrow. And the change has to be on a much smaller scale, and something that I feel that I can implement. And something very close to what Rory was saying by checking yourself. Yeah. And I think if as gay people, we in some way confront the homophobia that we've internalized and learn to be more natural and to be open and to contribute to conversations in a more natural, open way, that can change, can come about in that way. I'll give you an example from my life. So say, for example, I'm walking down the street with one of my girlfriends, a female friend, speaking openly about myself, my relationships. I feel very free with women. I feel like I can talk openly with them. And then we bump into two friends of hers who I perceive to be heterosexual. And I notice a change. I notice I start to pull back. I notice I'm not giving as much of myself anymore. And so say we go for coffee and we're all sitting and having coffee. And I notice that, say, the heterosexual man says something like, last year I had a fight with my girlfriend and broke up on holiday. Instead of saying something like, oh, that happened to me too with my boyfriend, I would just be silent and I would be holding back, kind of to protect myself from any weird responses, but also sort of protecting them from the responsibility for being open-minded or for accepting me. And I was just like, let's not deal with that. Let's just sit here quietly and let them have the conversation. And then when I'm alone with my girlfriend again, we can pick up where we left off. And I think if I changed that, you know, if I was found a way, and I think I am finding a way to be open with people who I perceive to be heterosexual, in a way, they're not saying that I'm gay all the time or not coming out all the time, but just simply contributing to the conversation in a way that's open and in a way that shows that my relationships are as valuable as theirs.
But you're putting all the responsibility for change behaviour on yourself there. Surely it's, you know, young boys shouldn't be going around abusing men like you and calling you those F-words.
I think if young boys like that, so say, had a cousin or an uncle who was behaving in that way, who when they went to visit them in their house and they weren't weird and they were just, you know, this is my boyfriend and this is what we're doing next year for holiday, or, you know, if they were just being natural, then it would be harder for them to behave in that way.
Lots of people saying nice things. Kieran says, text, great interview. There's still a problem today. Always hyper alert if I'm walking, holding a hand of my boyfriend. It often causes fear and really shows affection in public. Do you feel that too? You just don't feel safe.
I do like to hold hands in public. It's something that I really like to do. But I don't think doing it, I feel as comfortable as a man and a woman doing it. I do. I am checking the responses of people.
Another David Whelan says, best wishes to Gavin. Unfortunately, homophobia is alive and well. Tragically, the younger generation appear to be the most homophobic. Education is the solution. Ignorance breeds hatred. Do you think that?
Yeah, I do. I think education is the absolute key. I think these conversations need to be had at home and they need to be had in school. Definitely.
The lovely thing is, though, your students in UL, when you had that terrible experience with those young boys, you were saying the love you got from your students was just superb as well, wasn't it?
It really was. I mean, there was three or four, the way I see it is there were 3 or 4 minutes of hate in my life, and then there were, it happened on the 1st of February, so almost a month of love and support, and I went down to teach the few days after the attack, and my face was huge, and my nose was broken, and my black eye, and my students were absolutely amazing. They gave me chocolates and they were really lovely.
And funny enough, last week on this show, I spoke to 4 women politicians just about all the online abuse they endure. And, you know, there was just after the death of Caroline Flack, etc. Harry Styles was beaten up on Valentine's night. I mean, why do you think some people do behave like this?
I think we all grow up with an imaginarium or a museum of images in our mind about what gay people look like, what they behave like. And for some people, their experience puts them in contact with gay people and they can therefore modify those images. And then some people perhaps don't have as much contact with gay people and so have maintained these images that they receive from wherever, media, family, community, wherever. And it's very important for them that in their minds, those images that they have in this museum of images, this imaginarium, are not, that they're not related to themselves, that they're distant from their own ego. They have to push them away in their minds. And one very strong way of pushing away those images from themselves is to attack someone who they believe matches those images. You know, but what they're attacking really is a figment of their imagination. They weren't attacking Gavin McRae. They were attacking someone who they saw matched some kind of image in their mind they wanted to be distant from. The only way I can understand it is that.
Hopefully you will stay in Ireland, will you? I know you're loving your job down in the UL.
I'm here for a year. My contract's for a year, so we'll see how it goes.
You stay. Do you think Ireland's different to other places, or do you think this could happen anywhere?
I think it could happen anywhere. I think it could happen anywhere. It was just unusual for me, and kind of that having come back after 20 years, that it was one of my first experiences having come back. For me, it was a revisitation. It wasn't a new experience for me. It was a revisitation of old bullying, old violence that I suffered as a kid. So in that, but when coming at it now, I can see the differences in Ireland. Now I'm listened to. Now I get onto the radio. Whereas before, you know, I don't feel I was listened to. And I also didn't feel I had the vocabulary to approach people about the problem. You know, this is happening. This needs to stop. I did, in some kind of roundabout way, approach people, but I wasn't really that forceful with it, you know. So I think, you know, I think Ireland has changed a huge amount, but I think there's still work to be done.
Well, Gavin, I hope it never happens to you again. We're also sorry it did. Best of luck with your writer in residence position at UL. And you're not here to promote your novel, but I want to mention it because it's such a beautiful book for my listeners. Beautifully written. It's a fascinating book you wrote called Mrs. Engels, about the woman who married Friedrich Engels. Everyone should buy it and read it.
Thanks
so much for coming in this morning. And mind yourself. Emer McBride is one of our most important writers. According to Anne Enright, she is a genius, and her first novel went on to scoop many of the most prestigious awards, including Kerry Group Book of the Year, the Bailey's Prize and the Goldsmiths Prize. But her first book languished for 9 years before a chance encounter in her local bookshop led to publication and her great success. And she now has just published her third novel called Strange Hotel. And Emer joins me now from the BBC studio in London. Good morning, Emer.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us. First of all, let's talk about your new novel, Strange Hotel. Tell me about it.
Well, you know, it's a very short book, but it's I think it's bigger on the inside. It's about a middle-aged woman who goes from hotel room to hotel room around the world, thinking about life and trying not to think about life.
And how long would you have been thinking about writing that novel? How long did it take you to come up with your plan and outline for that novel?
Well, you know, it wasn't the book that I was planning to write after The Lesser Bohemians. And I really sat down just to write a short story. It evolved and kept growing as I went along. So it wasn't really something that was planned out. And I wrote it very quickly. I mean, it was over the course of a year, but it was probably about 3 months' work altogether.
Wow. Now, listen, let's go back to your first book, if that's okay. And I love the story of how it got published. I think, were you 27 when you wrote it, but it was rejected again and again? Because I think there might even be people listening this morning, Emer, and it will give them hope.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's a long story of failure, that's for sure. So I was 27 when I wrote it, and I was 36 by the time it was published.
But you never gave up believing in it.
Well, you know, I mean, that's not strictly true. I did put it in the drawer after a few years and think, okay, this isn't happening. Am I still a writer if I'm not a published writer? Do I still write if I'm a failure? And I kind of realised that I wasn't any good at anything else, so I'd have to just keep going with the writing. And so I started to work on The Lesser Bohemians, and I was about 6 years into writing that by the time Girl is a Half-Formed Thing was finally published.
And how did you eventually get it published? Tell us about the bookshop in Norwich, I think, where you and your husband William were living at the time.
That's right. Well, my husband was running the arts festival there, and he went into the local bookshop just, you know, for a gossip, mm-hmm. and started talking to Henry, who owned the bookshop. And Henry just said, what does your wife do? And he told him the long tale of, you know, failure and woe. And Henry said, oh, that's very interesting. Actually, me and some of my friends are thinking of setting up a little press. Do you think she'd let us read it? And that's how the book got published. It was, you know, men gossiping in a bookshop.
Isn't that amazing, though, Emery? Like, chance encounters, in a sense, almost changed your life.
I mean, it absolutely changed my life. And, you know, it kind of horrifies me sometimes to think that that might not have happened. He maybe wouldn't have gone in that day, or, you know, it was so easy and it could have been missed. So, you know, there was just so many ways it could have gone wrong and so many ways nothing could have changed. But, yeah, luckily for me, it did.
Let's go back, Emer. Now, you live in London now, but I gather you were born in Liverpool to Northern Irish parents.
That's right. And just before my third birthday, they moved back to Ireland, but to Sligo. And so I was kind of raised until I was about 14 in County Sligo. And then after that, we moved to Castlebar.
So was that Tupper Curry you went to live in?
That's right, yeah.
What was that like?
It was, I would say we were considered as blow-ins. and I can't say it was the happiest time of my life. It was, you know, I think we were very aware of not kind of coming from the local community. And I think particularly being, you know, having Northern Irish family at that time when people really just didn't want to think about the North was also a bit difficult. And so I would say when we moved to Castlebar, I was a whole lot happier all of a sudden.
And yours was a family, though, Emer, wasn't it, that read books? I mean, I think there was a particular bookshop, was there, in Sligo, which is no more, but that was very important in your young life.
Yeah, there was Cahan's in Sligo, which I just loved. I mean, we would just kind of run in there. And, you know, I mean, I grew up in a family that didn't really have much money, but if we wanted a book, we always got the book. Because reading was just considered to be completely foundational by my parents, and lucky for me that they felt like that.
Tell me, your parents, I think, were John and Geraldine. Were they both psychiatric nurses? That's not an easy job.
Yeah, that's right. I think my father was a qualified psychiatric nurse. My mother was. Wasn't a qualified psychiatric nurse, but she also worked in psychiatric hospitals. And I think it was, you know, very difficult. And I think particularly when they worked in hospitals in England, there was at that time, you know, in the 70s, you know, a culture of really not treating people with mental illness well. And and they also worked in hospitals where there were sort of people who had committed a lot of crimes. And I think that, you know, those just weren't easy jobs to have.
And into every life often comes darkness or shade. You were only 8 when your dad, John, died. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Just a while before my 9th birthday.
Do you remember him well?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, of course, less as the years go by and the details fade. But I have very fond memories. Who was full of interest in the world, who had to do a lot of overtime and didn't have much time, but whatever time he had was always, you know, willing to give it to me. And so, you know, I didn't have him for long, but what I had was good.
He died of cancer, I think, did he?
That's right, yeah.
Now that you've got a bit older, Emer, do you look back and think what a profound loss that is when you lose your father so young? Is that something you only process when you get a bit older or maybe even become a parent yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think about him more since I've had my daughter, and I look at her and I can obviously see myself at that age, and I hate the thought that anything like that she would have to go through something like that. And yeah, I mean, at the time, of course, when you're little, you're just so, everything's so present, and you're just going forward and going forward, and that becomes your life. And it's only, you know, when you get some distance from it, you look back and think that was hard. That was really hard.
You like Castlebar, and I think you loved the cinema there. And there was, I think, a very good local drama scene going on, which fueled your original love of acting.
Yeah, I mean, Castlebar was great. It was like moving to New York or something. you know, there was a great library, which there still is. There was a local bookshop. There was a cinema for the first time. I could go to the cinema every weekend if I wanted to. And yeah, and then, of course, there was the Linen Hall Arts Centre, which, you know, it was the first, you know, my first encounter with Pinter was going to see something that they had on in there. So it was suddenly having like access to culture that I'd kind of been starving for, and that was absolutely great.
You left Ireland young. I think you were 17 to go to drama school in London. Why drama?
I don't. I'm going to say I don't know, but actually I do know, of course. I think. Well, my mother first sent me to drama classes after my father died, I think, as a kind of means of expression. And, you know, so I did all the feshes in Sligo, the Fesh Sligi and the Fesh Kill and all of that. And I loved it. And I also, I think it really was grounded in my love of language, although, of course, I didn't realise that then, that it was, you know, I kind of loved learning lines and figuring out how to, you know, make language get up on its feet and be human. And that's, you know, that's something that's still with me now. But that's where that started.
And was it there, or you met your husband quite young, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I met him at drama school. He was a few years older than me. He'd already been to university, but he did the directing course there. So we've been together ever since.
Which is good. And he got a publisher for your first novel.
I know. I mean, he was a keeper, clearly.
Yeah, definitely.
I was right.
You dedicated, of course, A Girl Is Half One Thing to your brother, Donna. I think you were only 22. He was 28. I think he originally was diagnosed with a brain tumour. But you said it made you understand, Emer, that the world was more savage than you had wanted to accept it as.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think by the time I had got to my 20s, I had sort of, in a way, decided the bad things that had happened to me were over and everything was going to be great for the rest of my life. And then obviously, you know, him becoming ill and dying really shattered that. So it was, you know, it was losing him and how terrible it was to see him go through that. And it was also the kind of shattering of all my illusions about how the world worked and was going to work. And, you know, and as with any bereavement, you know, you're never the same, but it really, like, it really profoundly changed me.
In what way?
I think after that, I became someone who's much less interested in lying to myself. not that I think I was particularly, keen on it before, but I think I'm just someone who has very little time for illusions. And also, I suppose, spirituality. It's something that's really grounded me in the idea that you have to take this life seriously, because this is what there is, and kind of pretending that it doesn't matter, or that, you know, what comes after it will make up for everything that happens in this life, that this is all, you know, untrue, and a way to kind of prevent people from being difficult. And it's really important to be difficult, because life is hard, and people are unfair, and life is just unfair. You know, it was not fair for my brother to die at 28 years old, but that's just the way life is. And I think I just became someone who was much more interested in going toe to toe with life, and not hiding from the difficult things.
So did it make you more spiritual when you mentioned spirituality?
No, I mean, it's made me really quite anti-spirituality. I think I often get very frustrated with this kind of notion that the universe will take care of you, and that if things are meant to happen, they will. You know, I don't believe any of that. I don't believe in waiting. I kind of believe in really, really engaging in life.
That this is it.
Yeah, the chances are this is it. I mean, if it's not, great, but, you know, I have no reason to suspect otherwise.
Were you, I know people, you know, who've lost a sibling or someone young. Did it make you angry that your brother had his life stolen away from him?
Yeah, of course. And guilty as well. That why him? After all he'd already been through in his life, why that, and the cruelty of it. I mean, I don't think you can watch someone young die and someone who doesn't want to die and not find that incredibly difficult to accept.
You went away, did you, for a while after that, did you?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of realised that I didn't want to act at that point, that, you know, life was going to be something else, and I wasn't really sure what that was. So I went to Russia for a few months, to St. Petersburg, and it was there that I kind of finally thought, OK, now it's time to start taking writing seriously. I mean, I had been writing all the time since I was a child, and I always thought that I would, but I kind of became apparent to me at that point that it now was the moment to stop waiting. And so when I came back, I was living in London, and I was doing just a lot of temping to pay the rent. But I would get up at 5 a.m. and work and write for, you know, maybe 2 hours before I would go into whichever terrible switchboard I had to operate that day. and not very well. And so that was kind of how I learned to be a writer. And all the writing was really bad. Like, it wasn't, like, there's nothing salvageable from that time. But it was learning how to write. It was getting the kind of the muscles in order. It was, you know, becoming disciplined. It was taking writing seriously. And so when the moment came, right, I finally had the time away from temping where I could sit down and work, I was ready to go.
I mean, that book has been compared by some people to Ulysses. I mean, how do you describe your own writing? I think you said you're interested in the underneath of everything, the inside of everything. What do you mean by that?
I suppose I'm really interested in the kind of the tools for building people, how we build ourselves, how we are built, how we react against things that we are supposed to be. And I'm not really interested in writing about class or wealth or politics, or, you know, I think my interest in those things comes out in the books, but I don't set out to make a point that I feel the world needs to hear. I'm just really interested in how people become themselves or get kind of separated from themselves. And I suppose to do that, it feels that naturally language has to work in a different way. And I suppose that became, that's how the kind of the interest in modernism came around, where, of course, you know, the content and the form, you know, you put them together and you make them kind of do the same thing at the same time in a way which is different to more kind of social realist writing. It's really people, and maybe that also comes from the interest in acting, that, you know, character is just very interesting to me.
And I think this is right, you don't like a happy ending where people write a book about difficult things and then everything in the end is tied up.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there is a rule for how a book should end. You know, Girls Have From Thing ends, you know, in a difficult way. Les Bohemians ends more happily. Strange Hotel ends kind of ambiguously. So I don't think there's a rule. But what I really do object to is when people sew things up neatly at the end, or that the characters go through an experience and then it's over and they're fine, because I don't think that is how people are in life. You know, we take everything with us wherever we go, and sometimes that load is light and sometimes that load is heavy, but, you know, you don't get over your life. You are, you know, until the moment you die, you are in it and all of it is with you. And I suppose I also object to the notion that people having to be all right, that, you know, sometimes you're just not all right, and that's okay. And I really dislike this whole push in our culture to kind of smile or you're gonna die, and you know, I just think that's terrible. Like, you can just feel terrible if something terrible happens to you, and that's okay. That's, you know, you don't have to be better. You can just have a bad time and hopefully one day it will improve. But, you know, I don't like this kind of, oh, we have to provide a bit of hope at the end of the book. I think unless it's occurring naturally, don't impose it. Just, you know, let people feel unhappy. It's okay.
You also once said, Emer, that if you could be reborn as anyone, it would be as James Joyce on the day he finished Ulysses. Why?
I think he must have felt amazingly filled with delight at himself. And my God, imagine writing that book and all the time that it took him and all that it cost him to do it and to finally arrive at the end. You know, that must have been an amazing feeling.
Do you think, and I don't know the answer to this, but do you think women writers have a more difficult time than male writers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's kind of glaringly obvious that women are not treated with the same degree of seriousness. I think you can see it in the way that women's writing is reviewed. I think you can see it in the way editors often pick reviewers who are completely unsuitable for a book, and then they kind of maul it because they don't understand, where you get some kind of elderly man reviewing a book by a young woman and, you know, ripping it to bits. And you're like, why is that person reviewing that book in the first place? I mean, it's just ridiculous. And I think women's interest in their own lives is often treated as of less import than the grand novels of the great old men who are writing about the state of the world. But you know, and I think it's such a lazy lie, and it's incredibly frustrating to see really wonderful writers being passed over and their work being kind of dismissed or diminished by this kind of culture of, well, you know, it's grand, it's a grand book, but, you know, for a woman. But, you know, they're not writing about the great themes. And yeah, and I think that, I mean, I think things have improved, but I think that culture is still, you know, there are a lot of angry men out there who don't really want it to have changed.
Well, look, Emer, congrats on all your success. Your new book, Strange Hotel, is published by Faber. Looks like it's going to be as successful as the others. Emer McBride, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us this morning.
Thank you very much.
And I have to say, in social media, there's so much love and kindness out there this morning, both for Emer and for Gavin. First of all, and Emer, well done to your guest. Just be wonderful self. Wishing you well. That's to Emer and to Gavin. Another says, brilliant interview in Miriam with writer Emer McBride. Now touching on identity and purpose and life. Definitely worth catching. Jackie Lynham says, great to hear Emer on Radio 1 chatting to Miriam. Such an interesting guest. Have read her brilliant books, but this is my first time hearing an in-depth interview with her. Lovely interview with Emer. Rory O'Sullivan says, what an absolute breath of fresh air Emer is. I could listen to her all day. Chance Encounters in a Bookshop in Norwich being discussed at the moment. Hopefully it will put Norwich on the map, so says Orla. And back to Gavin. I mean, it's so important that we do these stories, everyone says, to make sure that gay people do not receive this abuse. Tom says, Miriam, Gavin's story is one that's been repeated over centuries. As an old queen, I worked in the door of gay clubs many years ago. I remember groups of young thugs would attack the club with stones. Many of the young thugs who attacked the club would return as patrons soon afterwards. Need I say more? Another says, Ken McHugh says that Sport Against Racism do football versus discrimination workshops in schools. That includes homophobia, but they have limited access to schools with Roman Catholic ethos. And one more, one of our listeners says, Miriam, my eldest is 10 and I have heard his peers using gay as a derogatory term or insult for the last 2 years. It starts very young. It has to be coming from the home. Well, hopefully this interview today will change that. Malachy Brown is one of our most brilliant journalists, and this week he added yet another award to his growing shelf of awards for his outstanding work. Born in Limerick, after training in engineering, he began his career on Village Magazine before moving to Mark Little's Storyful. He's now a producer at the New York Times, where he and his team create forensic and detailed video journalism. This week, it was a prestigious Polk Award he won. He's also an Emmy winner. And Malachy, who of course lives in New York, has very kindly got up at dawn to chat to me this morning. Good morning, Malachy.
Good morning, Miriam.
And listen, congratulations. You need to stop winning all these awards. You won't have a shelf left for them all.
Yeah, I know. I mean, those things are weren't really on the radar a couple of years ago, but anyway, they're going for awards over here.
But it's absolutely brilliant. Tell me, I've been looking at those brilliant, you know, video journalism you do for the New York Times. For our listeners, Malachy, tell them about the kind of work you do, you know, this new form of journalism, the painstaking reconstruction of events to tell the story using visuals and video.
Yeah, I suppose the work is kind of grounded in the idea that nowadays almost everything is caught on camera. You know, it could be cell phone video or security camera or satellite imagery. There's much more of that nowadays. And if someone is lying, you know, if the Iran says it didn't shoot down a passenger plane or the US military denies bombing a house in Afghanistan, that, you know, there's probably visual evidence out there that we can find and analyze to show what happened and then, you know, reveal the truth about an event.
I mean, I've been watching your stuff and I recommend people, they should watch it. I mean, you've constructed, you know, that deadly weapons attack in Syria, the forensic 10 minutes of the Las Vegas concert shooting, the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, haven't you?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. I mean, if you take the Vegas shooting, for instance, I mean, the problem there was that the police remained very tight-lipped when they were investigating it. They changed details about the start time of it and the police response came under scrutiny. The conspiracy theories started swirling about multiple shooters and what have you. And, you know, despite that barrage of fire, for instance, you know, we were able to reconstruct it because people kept their cell phones running. And by looking at the, you know, as gruesome as they were, the bursts of gunfire had an audio fingerprint, the duration of each burst, the interval to the next burst. And then when you looked at, like, the audio signature, each crack of a bullet had a spike in the audio file and you could line them up. And I realized we could reconstruct the whole thing in video from multiple different angles and then examine what went on, what went wrong, where the police first arrived, etc., when the gunman turned his gun indoors to fire down the hallway and so forth. And it was a very sort of detailed and immersive reconstruction of it. And similarly, in Douma, the chemical weapons attack, you know, killed, you know, I think around 80 people. And Russia and Syria very forcefully denied that, even brought so-called witnesses to The Hague. But the when you focused in on, you know, the visual forensic evidence that was there, you know, they denied that the whole thing happened. But there was video of the chlorine canister in situ covered in a layer of ice. And I didn't know what that meant, but by calling the Chlorine Institute, they said, yeah, this is what's called auto-refrigeration. When it decompresses really quickly, a layer of ice forms around it, which to me journalistically meant, oh, this is an active bomb. If I can find the guy who filmed that, I can establish when it happened.
Wow. And I mean, your journalism has impact. I mean, it's forced government investigations, Maliki. It's been used in UN reports, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, it might be innovative, you know, in that sense, but it's rooted in traditional journalistic questions like where something happened, when it happened, how it happened, and who carried it out, you know. And when the facts are indisputable, it's kind of hard to keep denying it. So, yeah, it's sparked investigations in Nigeria where the military shot on the unarmed protesters, or in Israel, where a medic was killed in Gaza during protests there, and the American military as well have reviewed airstrikes that they've carried out. And even like here in New York, you know, it was used in a murder trial of a kid who was caught up in gang violence a couple of years ago as well. So it can be useful to authorities and investigating bodies as well. And I think
No, go on, Maliki.
And the most recent work, I think, on Russia bombing hospitals, I think we spent months and months on that because it has been so hard through that conflict to assign blame to any one particular party for, you know, bombing civilians. You know, we were able to do that through that line of stories.
And also, you use in different stories like the Khashoggi one, you use a software. Like, did you use facial recognition software there to find out who the men were who were actually entering that Saudi consulate?
Yeah, it was. We tried facial recognition technology, but it was me zooming in on photographs and looking at earlobes and nose bridges and what have you.
You did good.
That was the technology. But you know, through that whole saga, you know, the Turkish media were drip feeding, you know, little factoids to keep the pressure on Saudi Arabia because they were denying that they had killed him at that point. And, you know, once we got the names of these fellows who were suspects in it, we wanted to find out who they were. Were they government officials? How close were they to the crown prince? And, you know, what was the likelihood that this thing was premeditated, a premeditated hit job, basically, that was sanctioned by the state? And we were, like, there were all sorts of clues out there on LinkedIn, on Facebook, and on Twitter. And we got email addresses linked to these guys. And then through our traditional sources in Turkey, we had very good sources close to the investigation that was going on in Turkey. We got the phone numbers and passport numbers of a lot of these fellows as well. So we were able to come out. There were 15 of them. And within a week, we were able to name 9 of them as high-ranking members of the Saudi government, and some of them were in the Crown Prince's office and, you know, were side-by-side with him on his global tour earlier that year. We found them, you know, in multiple cities in the U.S. and Europe. And the idea that, you know, they would go behind his back, you know, and without his say-so, assassinate one of his greatest critics was just, you know, not really believable.
I mean, brilliant journalism. You are living the dream, Maliki Brown. Of course, your uncle's Vincent, so you have that brilliant journalism in your DNA. Do you wake up every morning and think, I'm working for the New York Times, I am living in New York, this is pretty cool?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoy it. I love it, man, to be honest with you. You know, it's great. Like, and it's, you know, there's few newsrooms, I suppose, that would give you the resources and the time even, you know, to investigate these stories. And, you know, yeah, so it's great. And we're building a small little team. It's kind of like a little startup within the time. So we have the muscle of the newsroom to help us when we need to do that. So so it's great. And it's, you know, if I give a little spiel, it's because we've got subscribers. You know, the subscribers are allowing the newsroom to expand. and keep hiring journalists, which is rare in this time.
Yeah, and that's an important point to make. Subscribers, you know, keep great journalism going. Lots of love for you as well online. Lots of people saying, fascinating interview with Malachy Brown. Another person, Rosie McDonough, says, Malachy's a beautiful person. He took a chance on my writing many years ago. I'm very grateful to him. Malachy, we're all basking in your success. Thanks so much. Congratulations and keep up your great work. And you can go back to bed now.
Thanks, Miriam.
Thanks so much.